Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In the struggle to prevent massive fossil fuel projects from transforming Northwest communities into centers for oil, coal, and frack gas facilities, proponents of these projects claim these terminals, refineries, and production facilities will create much-needed jobs. While this claim flies in the face of actual job creation statistics, it resonates with people who have felt ignored by the environmental and climate justice movements. In the meantime, communities of color and working-class white communities bear the brunt of the pollution and other negative impacts of fossil fuel development. Today, we talk with Maria Hernandez-Segoviano, advocacy coordinator for Opal Environmental Justice Oregon, about the movement to create a just transition from fossil fuels to a renewable future. Maria, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you.
Well, actually, this term just transition has been thrown around now for a few years. I first started hearing about it from grassroots groups, particularly groups that were based in communities of color. But lately, cities like Portland, I think, have just transition task force and things. It's kind of mainstreaming itself. But I'm wondering, well, two parts. First of all, we should talk about what you mean by just, or what one means by just transition. And do you feel that the kind of mainstreaming of this concept is keeping its core principles intact?
That's a really good question. And so first of all, thank you for having me again. In order to talk about just transition, we first have to sort of talk about and acknowledge, right, where that definition first came from. As you all know, the just transition sort of came out of the labor movement. And the labor movement defined that sort of framework as an economy-wide process that produces the plans, policies, and or investments that lead to a future where all jobs are green jobs, right, and sustainable jobs that are also free from zero carbon. And so as we think about and broaden that definition at the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, it's looking at a just transition framework that really is a global framework that leads us from how do we move and shift our current economy, which is an extractive economy, and by that I mean, you know, it's focused on those same projects that you just mentioned, very rooted in fossil fuel exploitation of our labor, exploitation of just generally the collaboration of our people. And so how do we move and shift that to one that is collaborative, one that is also rooted in the culture and land of the people who started first being the first advocates of environmental justice? And so to your point about whether they, this definition or this movement has kept its core values, the core values at first, we talk about self-determination. So Oregon Just Transition Alliance is building on a core of values that is set to really come out of the grassroots and come out of the people who are continuously impacted by the exploitation of our labor, the exploitation of our economy, and also climate change. And so as we move forward towards this model and this framework, we definitely do want to keep the core principles of environmental justice.
Well, I found it interesting that you said this idea actually was generated in the labor union movement, because I've been spending a lot of time up in Cowlitz County, Washington, and there the labor movement seems to be really, or the labor unions are really hooked on fossil fuel development. And it's interesting. I mean, it seems like it's a mixed bag. I know, like, the longshoremen in Vancouver, Washington, were the first to come out against the oil terminal, the Cicero Savage oil terminal. But up in Longview, in that area, they are really behind the Millennium Bulk Coal Terminal. That's would be North America's largest coal terminal, and also the methanol refinery that's being proposed in Kalama, which would be the world's largest methanol refinery. And they talk about, you know, they need the jobs. And it's been very interesting to go to these meetings in rural Southwest Washington and see it's really a classic case of the environmentalists. Many of the environmentalists are people who are kind of just ordinary people living in the community who are concerned about the health of their community. They're not all like long-term environmentalists, but they're pitted against the labor union, or the labor unions as electrical workers and the building trades. So I'm wondering, when you talk about just transition coming out of the labor movement, was this a universal concern of the labor movement, or is it particular unions that actually are more on the progressive front?
If I understand your question correctly, it's thinking about, right, like the just transition and sort of how that definition in itself, it's universalist.
No, actually, I'm just curious about how, you said that it really came from the labor movement originally, but I'm wondering, like, the labor movement is not just a monolithic thing. There's a lot of different parts of the labor movement, and I'm wondering what part of the labor movement did it come out of, and how much how well can that part of the labor movement communicate with people, unions like the electrical union, who are right now really supporting fossil fuel development?
Well, to that question, I first will add that when the just transition term came out of the labor movement, it was really focused on how do we move from good jobs to green jobs, right? Green jobs that really had good paying wage, that had good working conditions. So, but we also talk about green jobs in the sense that as we move towards renewable sources of, towards our climate, that we also think about the labor component that exists within those projects. I think overall, when we think about now the just transition definition that we are working with, it's expanding that definition. It's expanding that it's not just about, jobs. It's about also having a social justice component, because in the same frame that is being said, a transition is inevitable, but justice is not. And so how do we work together to make sure that the same communities who have historically been impacted by the lack of good jobs, the lack of any job whatsoever even, right, are gaining those jobs, but they're also gaining those jobs with a social justice framework that looks at a racial component, looks at a gender component, and that quite frankly moves us towards a zero carbon economy. Noting that it is important for us to consider the labor components. And that's why, right, we are having those conversations, and we must come to the table to define what we mean together as a movement towards a just transition.
Well, it's interesting that I think a lot of people think of including communities of color, think of the environmental movement as a white movement. And actually, when you look at a lot of the environmental rallies and things, there's a lot of white people in it. I personally know a lot of white environmentalists who are really aware of that problem and have, and they are embracing the whole concept of just transition and like going to your group to learn. But I wonder how the other side that's kind of ironic is that the people who are really the brunt of environmental injustice are mainly communities of color and also poor white people, like people in Longview. So how do you bring that together? How do we get past the point of just thinking or just seeing the environmental movement as a bunch of white people trying to, I'm thinking some of the things that some of the workers who are supporting the fossil fuel projects in Southwest Washington, the way they kind of demonize these people who basically are wealthy and self-satisfied and can afford to, recycle or, have a Prius or something like that.
That, when I think about the question and I think about how do we come together to really not just come up with what we ideally like to see in our earth, right? Because as a note, we only have one. And I think everyone should be noted, right, that we must continue to find ways and how do we protect our earth that can sustain us for seven generations forward. In that same vein, we have to also think about who, to your point, who continuously have been placed with the burden of not having options or not having choices of what to do. I mean, it is a fact. Low-income communities, communities of color, indigenous communities, you name it, have definitely bear the burden of being the first ones and the worst being hurt by our climate change. And so we understand that in this process of making sure that we move from projects that are not necessarily focused on destructing our earth, we need to come together. And so to the question about how, right, and very concretely, first of all, relationships. Relationships are truly, it may sound at first very idealistic, but coming to the same space together and really being honest, right, and truthful about the fact that while we all are impacted by climate change, there are certain individuals who have historically been impacted, but are impacted even worse. And so thinking about building on that analysis together and building on work that we need to understand that it is time to start also listening, right, to communities who perhaps have not had the opportunity and continue to not have the opportunity to lead their solutions. We need to start to listen and follow the lead. I know that can be hard to some individuals, but it is important as we consider how are we going to make sure that we are moving towards a better place, and also an additional considering how all of those things come together.
Well, one of the things that strikes me when I look at literature about the whole concept of just transition, it's seeming to be bringing together a lot of different movements. And it reminds me of a friend of mine who, in a book one time, talked about that demonstration we went to, which was against everything bad and for everything good. And yet, I was looking at the principles of environmental justice, which was put together by the First National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit back in 1991. Mm-hmm. So this is going back a really long time. And there's 17 principles. And it covers just about everything I could think about that we really need to change and think about. So how is this different from other movements? Because there have been coalitions forever of different interest groups that come together around particular issues. But what is the difference between just having a coalition around a certain interest and actually coming together to create a just transition around these principles that encompass everything good and are, you know, against everything bad?
Well, first of all, I would say that, you know, communities who are fighting the good fight and are on the front lines fighting the issues of anti-immigration policies or fighting the issues around, you know, gender injustice. All of those issues are being led by individuals who oftentimes are, because of our arena, and hence I don't want to mention what is happening on our federal level, because we all know, we are forced to respond, right? Oftentimes leading no time to be proactive. So when we think about environmental justice principles and just transition, we really are talking that we are not working in silos. While we are fighting the fight around anti-immigration policies, we should be fighting the fight around, you know, gender injustice and criminal injustice. And so we bring those together, understanding that environmental justice is all of those things. Because in all of those movements and in all of those areas, we have what it's called, you know, the pillars of the economy working together. We have people, we have the work conditions, we have the resources for a specific purpose. And so in that purpose of us fighting for the good or fighting against the bad, right, those are glued together by these sort of conditions of a governance and are also moved together with this idea of a certain mindset. And the mindset that we currently operate on is one of wealth and for the 1%. And so overall, when we talk about environmental justice principles, which I also, you know, I love them, and not just love them, but they really speak to the fact that we all need to work together intersectionally. We cannot continue to think that immigration is not a part of an environmental movement, because it is. And we cannot continue to also think that when we think of, you know, fossil fuel projects and fighting against them, it's not part of a job construction or job, I want to say, working conditions, good working conditions. All of that is interconnected. Hence why we must bridge all those together and really think about how do working for one will affect the other, or how does working for something against something will impact individuals who are on the ground continuously, who oftentimes, and in fact almost always, played all of those identities. An immigrant individual may not potentially, who may be a low income, is also maybe someone who doesn't have access to the same things about clean water. And we can talk about examples on a global scale, all the way to a local scale, right, of who are the same peoples bearing all of those injustices from all of those movements.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Maria Hernandez Segoviano, who's the advocacy coordinator for Opal Environmental Justice Oregon, which is a group, if you haven't heard about them, you should find out more, because they are really, I think, leading a push in within the environmental movement to really focus in a very concrete way about what environmental justice is. And we're going to talk a bit more about that in just a moment. And we're talking about building a just transition as we work to build a renewable future. There's something I pulled off of the Opal website, which had to do with building movements that take on the ecological crisis, the economic crisis, and the crisis of empire. So I'd like to talk about how do you bring those three together? Because I have been involved in groups that do all three of those things separately. So what happens synergistically when you bring them all together?
Well, let me give you a quick example. And by the quick example, I'll draw from certain experiences, right, of a worker, a community member who's a worker and is employed in whatever sector you can, anyone listening can, the scenario can be any. They're a worker who oftentimes experience the injustices of not having working conditions, having to work two jobs to make ends meet. Then you have the fact that economically, right, so that economically they're being exploited. And then you also talk about the environmental ecological injustice that occurs with that. And the ecological injustice that's happening to this particular individual who not only is being exploited, who then later on, right, like goes back to their home, and their home is in an area where it's predominantly like most burdened by air pollution. And then to top that off, right, like you talk about the crisis of empire, and the crisis of empire is this individual who's an immigrant is fighting against the fact that we have a certain individual in our office making decisions, right, that doesn't believe that they deserve the basic human rights of having good housing conditions because of just who they are or what they look like, right? So that same individual is experiencing all of those three crises at once. And when we talk about, bringing those things together, first of all, we must create that space to understand how all of those three things, crises, I should say, are impacting individuals on a day-to-day basis. And us bringing those together is really understanding that we are not, in our members and our individuals who we work with, are not just one individual experiencing one issue. They're experiencing all of those issues at once. So for us to not acknowledge that and to not start talking about how we can do those progressively, like, and connect them together, first of all, we're doing already an injustice to that. So bringing them together requires us to really bring an analysis of intersectionality and bring an analysis as well that we are very complex, special individuals. And we are individuals who, when I say special is because we are the core of, interacting with our environment. Our environment does not exist without people. And similarly, people do not exist without our environment, or in this case, our earth. So in short, really what I'm trying to say is that we must first create those spaces to really bring an analysis of how all of those crises interact with the people we're working with on a day-to-day basis. And similarly, we must really think about policies, projects, any kind of solution with that same mindset, that we're not creating something for just one crisis, or we're not finding a solution for one crisis, but we are finding a solution for all crises at once.
Well, you use the term intersectionality, which I've been hearing a lot in the last few years, but I think it doesn't mean much to some people. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you can describe what you mean by intersectionality.
I'll say, so I'm an immigrant. My family comes from an immigrant background. I first immigrated when I was 12 years old. I was a former farm worker, who you, if you all know, in our current farms, there's a lot of sexual violence, there's a lot of sexual injustice and sexual harassment, right? Additionally, I'm a woman. And if we all know, women in the United States gain less money for the work that they do, even though it might be the same as some individuals. And I also am someone, I'm an employee, right? But I'm an employee in a job that I love, in a space that I work. So when I mean intersectionality, I mean how are all of the identities that I just mentioned intersect with each other? And how, and as an example, how our current system functions to only tackle one at a time. But how are you going to tell me, and you know, how are we going to tell individuals that if they get to experience anti-immigration policies, we must focus on that first, because we won't get to tackle the fact that they're not getting paid good at the same time. So I mean intersectionality is specific to that, looking at all those identities from that individual and concretely looking at how we must put them together, because that's, I just mentioned I'm one individual, right? And so that's exactly what I mean. Does that answer your question?
Well, I'm also thinking about the three terms that we talked about before, the crisis of economy, the crisis of environment, and the crisis of empire. And when, and I think for historically, movements, social movements, political movements have focused on one. I do remember a high moment back in 1999 at the WTO demonstrations in Seattle, where there were these giant puppets or people in giant turtle costumes marching arm in arm with the Teamsters. And the big slogan was Teamsters and Turtles together. Mm-hmm. And then that coalition fell apart within months after that, because the Teamsters were concerned about jobs that were going to kill the turtles again. But I want to talk about the power of having these three things come together, because when you really look at it, if you do any kind of analysis, you understand that the environmental crisis and the economic crisis are really rooted in the imperialist crisis, mm-hmm. or the crisis of empire. And that, again, the crisis of empire is really kind of caused in some ways by the environmental crisis, because that's also feeding reasons why China's buying up farmland all around the world and really oppressing the people that are, losing their lands in third world countries. So let's talk about the power of bringing them together and the difference between seeing them as separate struggles and understanding the interconnection between those three struggles.
There definitely is a lot of power to that, because, you know, as Opal, we define power as organizing people and organizing money. And I think to your point, you know, the crisis of empire is definitely a glue that keeps all of this, all of the other two crises together, and it maintains them and vice versa, right? But when we think about a just transition way of looking at this crisis and looking at how do we then create not a crisis of empire, but how do we create a sacredness, being rooted in sacredness and culture and the well-being, and as someone mentions, self-affirming, life-affirming model, right? There's a lot of power within that, because for the first time, we're recognizing that, again, people and the environment are not separate. And when we talk about the creation of jobs and we talk about the creation of good, solid, renewable sourcing projects or like moving, right, of transitioning, moving, there's a lot of recognition that we must understand that all of this crisis playing together and seeing them together, that builds our analysis, and that builds on us understanding that we're not alone fighting one crisis at a time, that you and I are interconnected. And even though, you know, one may care more about the environment and I, let's say, might care more about social justice or whatever, it's not separate. Your fight is my fight. But there, and the quick but that I say is, like, in recognizing those things, we also need to understand that we need to start developing frameworks or a work of understanding that the same people who continue to be impacted are not in decision-making power. And so there's a difference of that power, right? Of there's power in knowing that this crisis are connected, but there's also even more power in knowing that the same people who continue to be impacted can lead in a powerful fight this movement.
Well, I was thinking about right after Donald Trump was elected president, and I went to this meeting, I think 350.org put on, and there was a webinar or web conference video thing with Bill McKibben and a bunch of other leaders. And one of the things that really struck me was, and this is the one of the few gifts we got from Donald Trump, I think. Most of the people besides Donald, I mean, the only person who was my age was Bill McKibben, and everybody else was your age, pretty much. And there were a lot of people of color. And Bill McKibben was very quiet, which I always thought of him as somebody who would dominate the conversation. He was very quiet. He looked like he was on the verge of tears. And he was basically giving over. He was basically saying, as much as, you know, we're all concerned about climate change, right now we have to think about the people who are the first targets of the Trump administration. And I heard that from a lot of environmental leaders. And I wonder if you saw a difference after the election of people, the largely white environmental movement, turning around to you and going, how can you help us? How can you help us understand what we need to understand and move forward?
Yes. I mean, we are living in an era or decade, I should say, where so-called leaders believe and have a certain narrative, right? That the only way to fix the problems is by taking us 100 years backwards. And so after the elections, there has definitely been a huge turn in individuals reaching out and wanting to understand, right? Wanting to understand more concretely what the experiences were, but also because, you know, it was shown that we don't live under this post-racial era. It was proven by the election of our current president that we, in fact, are way far beyond, you know, a post-racial era. And folks coming in and wanting to understand allows us and allow everyone as well to really recognize that, again, the fight wasn't, it's like it almost was an amplification of the fights that have already been happening for so long. And hence, you know, that's why I think it's important for individuals who have privilege to do that self-education to then later come in terms of how can you help us, but how can we support you? And there's a big difference between those two questions, right? Because then individuals who are continuously being impacted by this presidential individual, and I honestly don't want to call even his name because I don't think it's important.
I'll call him president for that matter.
Yeah, but anyways, so yeah, that's definitely the important piece I would take on is that it is important for us to continue to work together and continue supporting each other because support and help is quite different.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio and in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Maria Hernandez-Segoviano about what it means to work towards a just transition. Well, one of the things, this is the kind of, we'll let go of this guy you don't want to talk about by name in just a moment. But I was actually interviewing Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper days after the election. And he brought up a point which had been in the back of my mind, but really brought it forward when he also, like Bill McKibben, said, you know, I realized that as much as the issues I've been working on are really important, I have to really think about how to support the people who are really being attacked. And not only that, but the people he'd been working with, particularly around the Tesoro Savage oil terminal in Vancouver, who live in the Fruit Valley neighborhood of Vancouver, are largely Latino, largely refugees and immigrants. And so he was seeing them not only being, they've been attacked by the air pollution, but they live in the poverty and everything else. But they were now also going to be targeted for perhaps, I mean, for violence or for expulsion from this country. And it was an interesting moment to watch him looking at that. And somehow, I think there's a transformation when you see the issue that you're so wedded to suddenly get caught up in this much larger reality. And I wonder about that process. And I just, and I'm sure you probably have connections with some of the folks in Fruit Valley in Vancouver. But I'm wondering from the inside what it feels like to be in a basically a targeted and marginalized community of color, working really hard to change your reality, to have the kind of trauma that the election was, but then to feel, I mean, I guess how do you feel when the white environmental movement reaches out to you?
I would say to that question, it's an interesting question, and I will say this as an individual, from an individual perspective, right? Because I am the expert of my experience, and while I work with communities who are most impacted, I wouldn't necessarily call them continuously marginalized, but most impacted, that from my own perspective, right, there's two ways to look at things differently. There's a way of, like, why are they reaching out? What is the purpose? What is the idea of wanting to reach out to me particularly, right? And is it to fully include me in the conversation, or is it to tokenize me in a certain aspect? And so I always draw back to, you know, the Hemis principles of inclusion and organizing, and think about those two main questions. Why are they reaching out? And also, what is the purpose of that conversation or whatever that interaction may be? I personally feel, it is one of those things where it's like, I feel to an extent where there needs to be a recognition from that individual of sort of the process it has taken, right? For folks to feel in some ways like they can say no, and I can say no. So I feel empowered, not of them reaching out to me, but I feel empowered of having the ability to say no, or to take a step back and have agency to answer those questions. And I would say that oftentimes, you know, that doesn't come easy, because it's also a very interesting, like I said, it's a very interesting question. And I sort of navigate trying to answer your question, because even to that extent, it's like I'm asking, like, from you, like, why are you asking that question, right?
I'm actually was wondering myself why I was asking that. But I think that we get to that very uncomfortable place, and I'll speak for myself as a white liberal, mm-hmm. looking back at all the privilege that I've had in my life. And there's all these, I've had many opportunities to have that privilege just like thrown back in my face and seeing, you know, what it excludes. And I think that, because one of the things that's exciting to me about this movement of Just Transition and hearing a lot of people in the environmental movement like talking about it, and the fact that, well, we'll talk about this later, but you're doing a workshop with the Frack Gas, Stop Frack Gas Coalition this week. And I've talked to a number of people in the climate change movement who are very excited by Opal and really wanting to work with Opal. And but there's, I think, that discomfort where we and then start trying to figure out how do we get beyond that. And I think we get beyond it by actually acknowledging it in the first place. And so maybe that's why I asked the question, is to acknowledge my own, it's my own learning process in a way. And another thing I was thinking about was, I was growing up, the civil rights movement was going on, and it was like there were kind of a couple different dynamics between whites and blacks in the civil rights movement. There were a lot of whites who went down and took the leadership of the blacks. I mean, there's no question. And then there were, I think, a handful of white people who wanted to take ownership of it, as they always do. And that's been the dynamic whenever white people or people who are part of the power structure are trying to work with people who are being oppressed by the power structure. It seems to me with talking about Just Transition that it's really an effort to get beyond that dynamic.
It is. And so, and I appreciate the clarification in terms of the purpose of your question, because I would also say that our communities speak for ourselves, right? We all have a voice, and hence OPAL, organizing people, activating leaders. We organize knowing that everyone's voice is there, but perhaps the barriers that have been established by our systemic system, or just generally that are systemic, have prohibited that, right? Or in some ways not allowed for that to even happen. And so to the same question about us trying to do the work that goes beyond that, because I think it is important to acknowledge it and be uncomfortable, right? To then say, what do we need to do together to really listen and follow a lead that perhaps certain individuals have not followed before? So to go back a little bit to the question that you posted earlier in terms of how I feel when someone like who's white comes to me, like I said, it's really like, it's not a bad feeling. It really isn't. If it's depending on who the person also is, right? And what kind of education and acknowledgement they have done on their end before coming in to those terms. But I personally feel like, and especially with the work that I'm doing, is feeling that there's like this need for us to really be honest to each other and say, right, like, what are the things and what are the historical things and moments that have not allowed us to have those conversations? And so to anyone listening and wants to, you know, come to me and ask questions, I'm as one of those things, like, let's talk about what is the purpose of those conversations.
Well, I'm just thinking, like, one of my issues has been when I hear about just transition is I want it to be the answer. I want this is going to be what's going to break through the barriers. And often when I hear it being talked about, it's talked about in these kind of vague rhetorical terms. And I'm feeling like, especially, well, I won't say that. Anyway, it just feels like I think we don't even have the practice yet. This is maybe the opportunity to start having the practice of having to talk about these things in a real way. Mm-hmm. So actually, I want to get into some of the real stuff that you're doing. And one of the places that is real fascinating to me is the work that's going on in Southern Oregon and in Northern California to fight the Pacific Connector Pipeline that's connecting to Jordan Cove LNG Terminal, a pet project of that guy. We don't want to mention his name. And I want to talk about the work that OPAL is doing there in terms of, you're particularly working with the tribes who have been the leaders in fighting this project. But I wanted to get a sense of how you're working and what is the difference maybe with the way that you're working with them and with other people there compared to the way this struggle has been going on for like 3,000 or 4,000 years now. And it's literally about 11, 12 years. Mm-hmm. So how are you reaching out to the people there, both the tribes who are really going to be greatly impacted, and then all the other people down there who also are going to be really impacted?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would say that OPAL is supporting that fight. That fight really is carried forward by our partner organizations and tribes down there who are on the front lines, know what's going on, and are day by day experiencing the threats that this potential pipeline can have and would have in their communities, right? So we are following and supporting the lead of Rogue Climate, who's an organization down there, the Jurok and the Karuk tribes. And really what we're doing as OPAL is in this model, in this framework under a just transition, right? We need to start amplifying and shifting a narrative and creating a narrative that is led by the communities who are in the first place leading and fighting the fight. And so for us, how we're doing that is honestly following that lead, following the lead of our same communities and members, not only who are partners with us at OPAL, but who are members of OJTA, the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, to really be the one speaking. Because again, this goes back to, we speak for ourselves, right? And that same community have the answers, know what's happening, know what's gonna happen if this pipeline gets constructed, you know, like the nearly 400 rivers and streams that will be impacted, the thousands of landowners and property owners who are continuously being threatened because of their housing conditions and et cetera, but also like the same communities who depend on the rivers there and how that is so sacred and have been sacred. So that all just goes to say that our work really here in Portland, especially being in Portland, right, where it's all about Portland, no, it's not, right, is really trying to amplify that our fight, again, is connected, but the lead really comes from individuals who are bearing the continuous threats and they are experiencing and sort of thinking on a day-to-day, like, what am I going to do? So the way also we're reaching out is through this Oregon Just Transition Alliance and us members, we are really shifting that narrative and shifting the narrative that what happens in rural area is also something that Portland and urban areas need to know about. One, that's one thing. Two, is really amplifying, right, that we need to start looking at a broader component than just limiting ourselves and saying, well, that's a big fight that might not be possible. Like, we don't limit ourselves. We always try to envision what is that our communities want and need to then really start tackling how we're going to get there.
Well, one of the senses that I get, particularly when one allows, when one is led by the indigenous people, and the term water protector, which we started hearing a lot during the Standing Rock and the Dakota Access Pipeline struggle last year, it really came home to me. I was talking with Robin White, who's been a longtime activist, and he works with you guys. And he was talking about, he basically was really explaining what water protection means, because it's not just protecting those particular streams that the pipeline is going to go. It has to do with the idea that water is life. In fact, I have a poster of that in my studio, and I look at it every day, and I think about, you know, what that means. But when Robin was talking about that whole concept, it was really like, yeah, we are destroying our entire water supply. Interestingly, Rachel Carson wrote about the same thing back in 1962, which I'm just reading now. So let's talk a little bit about that concept of water as life and what a water protector means and how that is like another, I think, a leadership principle of the Just Transition movement.
Well, first of all, recognizing that I'm not, I don't think I can speak fully with that because, one, I am not with from an indigenous background. However, all I would say to this is that this is a principle of environmental justice, right? When we talk about who gets to experience what that comes from our Mother Earth and water being one thing, that's an environmental justice principle. So really, environmental justice looks at how people interact and get to experience the either, you know, consequences or benefits of our environment. And water being life, and in this current fight with the Jordan Cove pipeline, you know, to your point, it's not just about the streams, because if we talk about the streams and the 400 streams that will be impacted, sure, like, then there's no water. But we're talking about who lives around those streams and who will actually have access to clean water or, you know, and go forth. And we can talk about Standing Rock as an example. But overall, just in general, to not go farther within that, is just saying that water is life is also a concept of environmental justice and how the things that are streaming down our lakes and our rivers is also an important concept because of just who gets to interact on a day-to-day basis.
Well, we're talking this morning with Maria Hernandez Segoviano, who's with she's the FSC coordinator for OPAL Environmental Justice in Oregon. We're talking about Just Transition here on Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LP FM in Seattle. This is really mind-boggling. You know, this is, I was thinking as you were talking about how this is about everything. And actually, the term ecology to me is one of my favorite terms, because ecology is really about the interaction of everything. And so, in a way, I see that the just transition movement and environmental justice is really about the intersection, as we were talking about before, of economic justice, social justice, environmental justice, and the fight against imperialism. And I'm not exactly sure where I'm going to go with this, but there's... when we go there and we listen to the voices of the people who are most impacted, what do you think changes from the old paradigm where the experts would talk and everybody else would listen?
Can you repeat the question?
If we really use the principles of environmental justice, which bring together all these threads in a way that we look at kind of the ecology of reality as opposed to just, you know, the ecology on the earth, how does our way of interacting change when we're really listening to the voices of the people who are primarily being affected by the system not working the way it should work?
So first of all, you know, when we think about ecology of things, knowing that eco means home, right? We all have a home. And in fact, some don't. Or some, and we can go into the housing crisis and how that in itself is something that we must acknowledge, right? But the home being Earth, that's our home, right? And thinking about how historically our home has been managed to only benefit a few, and you mentioned it very concretely and concisely, right? We have fights of oils that are going on an international level. We have people fighting over water. In fact, people believe that water is going to be the next big fight. So when I think about eco and eco being our home, meaning Earth, right? I think about our first sort of fighters around, the ecology and our fight around environmental justice, and that being our indigenous individuals. But even drawing back all the way to, you know, the colonization over individuals, environmental injustice goes all the way to those levels. It goes back to slavery. And we all can argue that slavery is still even something that exists nowadays with our prison industrial complex fights and all of those things. However, I would say that because of that, and because of environmental racism and environmental injustice has continued to be over and over a thing the world continues to fighting about, we need to start then listening, who are the people who are always impacted but yet don't get to have a decision on the solutions that will potentially benefit them? And if it will benefit them, really asking for the concrete results, right? Because oftentimes when we think about right now in wanting to listen to individuals of color, we just talk about it from a framework perspective where we say, let's prioritize equity, let's prioritize environmental justice, let's prioritize, you know, investment in communities that deserve it. But those actually don't get to be a result. They typically are just prioritizations. So when we start listening to communities who are most impacted by those issues, environmental injustice, ecological injustice even, we need to actually think of results and investments. And a clear example that I can tell you, especially within our work, right, is our transit system, right? Our transit system is something, or public transit system, I should say, is something that would benefit not only our Earth because of less carbon emissions, et cetera. But we don't recognize that even within our transit system, there's a lot of intersections of injustices happening there, both in the labor exploitation format and also on the racism that continues to criminalize our folks on the buses. And
I mean, the ones who don't pay the fare.
Who don't pay the fare, right? But so to your question about if we were to start listening to individuals who are impacted by those issues, we would have service in Gresham. We would have service in the 40 to 60 mile quarter that doesn't have any service right now, right? We will have, instead of fare enforcers coming into the buses, we will have community liaisons talking about, you know, what safety means for them. We would also not have, like, continuously police investment, and instead have investment of coming into, like, mental health or health priority focused programs, etc. So that's exactly, like, what we mean. Like, it, we will see those changes concretely if we were to start listening to communities who are impacted by certain issues. And the same thing can go with immigration, etc.
Well, you just answered the question I was going to ask you, which is great. So the next thing is, how do we get there? Because your vision is really clear about, and this is just a handful. I mean, we could go on probably for next 2 hours with other concrete examples of what would change. Do you feel like what's happening at the city level here in Portland and in a lot of other cities is actually a meaningful shift in direction?
Like what?
Well, that, I mean, there's just transition work task force now. I think there's one in Portland. I think so. I mean, I hear, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought I've heard this being thrown around at city council meetings and things like that, that people, or at least people use that phrase, and I'm wondering how meaningful it is, and how do we actually get to a place where the principles and these 17 points of in the principles of environmental justice that I have in front of me, how these actually become realized in mm-hmm. in the way that our society is restructured?
Yeah, well... I'm not quite sure about the task force that you're referring to.
I might have made that up, actually. Maybe it's just wishful
thinking. No worries, but something for me to look into. However, I would say this, that whenever I think about making these steps concrete, right, we have principles that can take us there. And we have to, so we see these things like always coming into play in terms of, but show us, you know, how we can get there. Well, the thing is, the first step is to actually come together and talk about what our communities want and need. That's the first step. If we're ready to listen and wait for their leadership, we can get there. Second, in terms of, you know, like, if this is meaningful, whatever this is, I would refer back to, you know, what we're trying to do in terms of being meaningful is, it's not about having more participation. It's not about, you know, getting a lot of people into. It's about meaningful participation. Like, it's not about me and you having this conversation and have it transactional. It's like, how can we actually have a transformative relationship where the work that we do and the work that you do is connected and then gets amplified, right, through the lenses that we talked about. So that's how I would say, that's how we get there in a meaningful way. First, taking a step towards taking a breather, because we are really good at jumping on to, you know, things because we live in this crisis, right? I would just say that our first step is to come together, and that's what the Oregon Just Transition Alliance is trying to also create, like bring different perspectives, different communities together, different movements to build a movement where we really consider what are the meaningful ways that we can act and what are the solutions, right? Because you may ask right now, what are some of the solutions? The solutions are already happening. We talk about, you know, people doing transportation justice, immigration justice. Those are already solutions that we need to amplify. But how do we get there in a way where everyone who wants to be supportive of this just transition comes together and acknowledges that the people leading should lead through an environmental justice framework, or principles, but also through the just transition principles of self-determination, being led by frontline communities, being collaborative, not only at the local level, but also at the national level and international level. And how do we show that solidarity through our shifting of narratives? And quite frankly, how do we live? How do we live with the life-affirming model as well, where we consider as individual actions what we can do for the protection of our earth, but also what can we do individually for the protection of our people.
Well, one last thing, because I understand you have a workshop coming up this Thursday that you're working with the Stop Frack Gas Coalition. So I wanted to just talk a little about that workshop. And did they come to you? Did you come to them?
It was both. It was definitely both. But I appreciate, shout out to all the awesome leaders and the Frack Gas Coalition who are really doing that work and that education, not only within themselves, but also across the board. And we're going to be learning together and on Thursday. And that's something that I really value. And I'm really, really looking forward to it. It's going to be a workshop for us to get to these discussions together, and for us to start the first step of how do we work together while moving a just transition through the principles that I just kind of spoke about.
So is that an open meeting, or is it just for people who are part of that coalition?
I believe is right now just for the coalition. However, you can follow up definitely with some of the organizers there and see if they will welcome.
Yeah, because since I'm on the mailing list, I got the notice of it, and it occurred to me maybe not something to announce publicly. But I guess we got another moment left. I feel like it was a very positive move that the Frack Gas Coalition is doing this, because there have been people of color in the forefront of these movements all along, particularly in the fight against the Tesoro Savage oil terminal, which is not Frack Gas, but Frack Gas Coalition is kind of the second generation of that battle, to stand up against oil. So what sense does this give you that that this latest iteration of the fossil fuel, anti-fossil fuel movement, climate change movement, is really reaching out towards understanding what just transition means? I just wonder if you see that they're working out, that they're reaching out to do this workshop, if this is showing a new step in understanding about what just transition is.
Oh, absolutely. I mentioned, you know, for us, a just transition is, how do we shift from that current exploitative economy, right, to one that is life-affirming and is rooted in sacredness? And working with the Frack Gas Coalition, in general, working with any, you know, other organization, is how do we build honor perspectives, but also how do we work together in solidarity for not only, the protection of our earth, but the protection of our people. And it was amazing. And I'm really looking forward to Thursday. So yes, in short.
And I hope to see you there. Well, thanks a whole lot, Maria, for talking. It's been really great having you come in, and you've certainly put me on the spot a few times, and I really appreciate that. We've been talking today with Maria Hernandez-Saviano, who's the Advocacy Coordinator for OPAL Environmental Justice Oregon, and you've been listening to us here on KBOO Community Radio, Locus Focus, and also in Seattle on KBFG LPFM. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, I'll be talking about oil spills at dams along the Columbia River with Lauren Goldberg, who's a staff attorney for Columbia Riverkeeper. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Marvin Gaye. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
The blue skies go. Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Whoa.